Well, last week's Western Conference mailbag was so fun. We're going to do the Eastern Conference this week. Spent about 4 or 5 minutes on every team. We got just deluged with questions here. Basically every possible topic on every possible team. So let's get started here. We'll just go in alphabetical order, starting with the Atlanta Hawks. I guess since you see them all the time, I have a question I want to ask you, sure. Which is, what do you make out of the Chris Haynes reporting, as only he could, with the headline that Lloyd Pierce is not on the hot seat, and then talking about all the ways in which the Hawks have some dysfunction. But what's your thought on the feeling around that team, being around them probably more than anyone else?
You know, I think their expectations were a little inflated based on the way they closed the season last year. And I think people looked at, well, it's Trae Young and John Collins, and they forgot that they had other halfway decent veterans on that team to kind of help hold things together. And when you replace that with two other rookies, and really three, I mean, they're starting Bruno Fernando now too. You can't play 5 20-year-olds and win. And you can see, like, they're a horror show on defense. And I don't know why the expectation would have been any different than that. And I just think people got really ahead of themselves. And the way they started the season, too, was a little optimistic. And I think that sort of played into that. And now they're just getting this huge reality check that as talented as Trae Young is, he is about the worst defensive player in the league. And John Collins / Jabari Parker certainly aren't helping that any. And then your rookies on the wings aren't helping that any either. So you're going to be totally awful on one end. And without Collins, you're not a great offensive team by any stretch. You're a one-man band, basically. So I question the expectations there, because coming in, I thought this team would be quite bad, even if Trae Young played at a very high level, just because of the other pieces around them just weren't there yet.
Yeah, Trae, to me, has exceeded any reasonable expectations personally.
Certainly as an offensive player, he has. I mean, the only thing you can quibble about with him offensively is he doesn't shoot nearly as well on early clock 35-foot pull-ups as he thinks he does. I think that's something he could rein back a little, and I think the other players on his team would appreciate that too, to put it gently. But otherwise, he's a brilliant passer. He gets where he wants to go on the floor, just brutalizes people when he rejects screens and goes and takes it back to his left. You can get himself wide open threes off the dribble doing that. Just a really talented offensive player who basically can be the engine of a decent offense by himself. But he is truly tragic on defense. And that's one area that I think the Hawks have to invest more effort in, is really getting him to understand and appreciate that he at least needs to be halfway decent. You know, he needs to take the steps that Damian Lillard took to become a serviceable defensive player. And that's what lets your offense shine.
Yeah. And we're starting to hit on this already, but, Doc O'Carter, one of my favorite longtime followers, at N.O. Carter, why are the Hawks this bad? And I'm sure it's not just coaching or missing Collins, and he references their 143-120 loss to the Knicks. And so going back to that report by Haynes too, to me, all of this was eminently predictable before the season, as you started to talk about. And you mentioned the expectations. When I don't follow politics very closely, but you'll hear people talk about one of the things that you're supposed to do as a campaign is manage expectations, because you don't want it coming out in the media that, oh, hey, you are supposed to do really well in this primary and then you didn't. And now this guy's campaign is cratering and voters will think he doesn't have a chance to win and they're going to go elsewhere. Well, in the NBA, it's the opposite, right? You generally, coming into a season, you want to sell season tickets. I mean, it seems like there was a lot of excitement about the Hawks going into this year. You're definitely going to pump up expectations. And considering that they also won 7 games more last year than their point differential would have suggested, and then you throw in the clear issues at backup point guard. I mean, that game against Brooklyn, Trae's +5, they lose by 10.
Yeah, they would need to have a backup point guard before they could have an issue at backup point guard.
Yeah, the issues at center. And then you're going to tell me that you're going to play Cam Reddish, gift him 25 minutes a game, when, you know, which is clearly what the mandate is.
And, yes. You know, Herter, like, they, you know, it's interesting. Like the Laker game, they were able to generate a wide open corner three, but it wasn't Alan Crabb shooting it. It was Reddish. And, you know, if Crabb or another player had been in that position, maybe has a better chance of making it. And they send that game you know, in a different direction.
Yeah. I mean, even someone like Solomon Hill would be helping them now, but they traded him for Parsons. So all of these issues were eminently foreseeable before the start of the season. We talked about them before the start of the season. And, you know, to me, if you want to put the blame on anyone for not how bad they are right now, I think it's got to be Travis Schlenk for my standpoint. You know, I mean, they're playing Reddish this many minutes when he wasn't an effective player in the ACC last year. Like, it's not a surprise that he's not going to be getting any good and these wing guys aren't being any good. It looks like the bet that they made to move up for Hunter and give up a lot to get him is not working out so far. So I'm a little bit surprised that they're this bad, but mm-hmm. I mean, not much.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, the expectations game, I really think they should have gone in and, you know, it's one thing in your public statements, you don't really want to do that as much, but you can kind of low key pull a couple, you know, pull your beat reporters aside or whatever and just be like, look, here's the deal, right? Like, yeah. We're really young and we're going to get our asses kicked. Okay. And you, there's a way to do that and kind of manage the expectations better.
Yeah. Well, they also have all this cap space. And this is a question from basketball strategy. Are they 2 years away from the playoffs, 2 years away from 2 years away, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Got Fran Fischel. That quote is just going to live on forever. So yeah, I mean, what if you had to just predict it right now, when do you think the Hawks will next make the playoffs?
I think they can be in the race next year and make it the year after.
That seems about right to me, too. I mean, one at least good thing here is going to be they're having a good draft pick now this year.
Exactly.
Which we didn't necessarily think they would.
Yeah.
And they got $60 million in cap space. Now, are you going to get – maybe you aren't going to get what you would have gotten with your $60 million in cap space if they were challenging for the playoffs and winning 35 games this year and seemed on more of an upward trajectory. And it does seem like there's some friction around Lloyd Pierce as well. That's something that's going to need to be – sorted out for sure here. Okay, Boston, you want to pick one here?
Yeah, sure. B Twitter asks, is there a need for Boston to improve in the Brad Wanamaker spot, or is it moot come meaningful time anyways? I would love to see Chris Dunn there, which is kind of funny because that was one of that draft year, that was one of the rumors that Boston was going to take Chris Dunn.
A false rumor, as it turned out. They were not interested in the slightest from what I heard.
I think this is interesting because everyone is focused on Boston getting a center, but all the guys they could plausibly get are basically impossible salary matches. And the other thing you see with the Celtics is that they have five good players spread across four positions and is fine as long as all five are completely healthy in the same game and don't have fouls. But a sixth one would help them and is much more plausible for them to obtain, I think, than somebody who is a meaningful upgrade on Daniel Tice and fits in any kind of salary/trade construction whatsoever. So the thing you ask yourself is, would Boston be better off going after a $10 million wing player who is pretty good? And is that, does that type of player push them further forward than trying to trade for whatever center you want them to trade for when honestly, like Tice has been pretty good?
Yeah. Now, if he has to go against Embiid, he's going to get murdered, right? I mean, there are certain matchups that are going to be major problems for them. If they play against Milwaukee, he's going to get physically overwhelmed by Giannis, who a lot of times you want your center to guard. They just don't have anyone on this team really to guard Giannis at all. You know, maybe semi Ojale.
Ojale is probably their best Giannis defender. Like the one thing he does pretty well against Giannis and Ben Simmons is he plays way too far off guys, but like he doesn't let anybody get past him. So,
right.
So he can be effective in those minutes, but he's a complete and total zero on offense. And I think in a playoff situation, you just need more than that.
Yeah. No, I think that's right. Especially against a team like Milwaukee or Philly who are going to make it so difficult to score to begin with. But I mean, they have a lot of talent on this team and it's largely young talent. I don't think it's the end of the world if you just kind of grow with this. And had some cursory conversations with some of their guys at the showcase and basically their thought is just what we've been talking about. Like, who is this upgrade at center who's worth trading one of your five best players, i.e. five biggest salaries?
Mm-hmm.
There's nobody worth moving the Memphis pick for. At this point, who's available? So, I mean, if I had to guess, I think maybe there's one more low level move involving a second or something. Maybe it's the buyout market, although they don't have any exceptions left to use money to get those guys. It just has to be a prorated minimum, but they can offer a role to someone who's a little bit more veteran who gets bought out.
I think there's still a little bit of hope internally in Boston that by April, that maybe Romeo Langford or Grant Williams can play those minutes.
Yeah. Yeah. See, I mean, if Grant Williams could just make shots, I think he could be a valuable rotation player. But yeah, certainly relying on either of those guys in the playoffs, you know, it seems
dicey.
Less likely.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, you know, as good as Milwaukee is right now, I don't know that you're feeling like, oh man, the East is like there for the taking. Like, no matter who they get, they're not beating Milwaukee, in my opinion.
Well, certainly last year would provide some pretty good base of evidence that you would need to create vastly different conditions than a year ago.
Okay, let's do a quick lightning round here. We hit on a couple of these already. Is the general media overvaluation of Jason Tatum a result of a large portion of the media hailing from Boston? I do you agree that he is overvalued?
Ooh, maybe a little. Definitely his rookie year probably, but yeah. I don't know. I think it's sort of leveled off a little. I think people are talking more about Jaylen Brown now, rightfully, than about Tatum, but Tatum's a good young player. Like there's, you know, like what do you want us to say?
Right. Is he like no brainer max extension to you this offseason?
I think so. I mean, based on some of the other ones that have happened, I mean, but seriously, like a young wing player with size, like that's what everyone's looking for, right? They can play across three positions, basically. Like, yeah, that's a definite match. Like we were talking about with Brandon Ingram last week. Like, certainly, if you're going to max Ingram, you would max Tatum, right?
Maybe. I mean, is Ingram playing better now than Tatum has? I don't know. Tough to say. Ingram, just that defensive ecosystem in New Orleans is so bad right now. I think it's really hard to judge anybody. But yeah, Tatum is interesting. The on-off numbers are very, very favorable to him right now, but part of that is the issues that they've had with their bench. Okay, quick break here, and then we'll talk a little Brooklyn Nets. Masterclass is offering you an awesome deal for the holidays. Buy one all-access pass, which gets you over 70 wide-ranging class offerings, and you get one free to gift as well. Two for one, one for yourself and one to gift at masterclass.com/PER. That's right, John invented PER. Easy to remember that one, isn't it? I just am so impressed with the quality of Masterclass. My wife actually started using it before we knew they were even going to be on the program. She's interested in getting more into writing. So she did Margaret Atwood's class, which she thought was awesome. A lot of great exercises for her to get better. Steph Curry, of course, has shooting and ball handling. Serena Williams does tennis. This is really cinema style quality. Acting from a number of awesome actors, including Samuel L. Jackson. Annie Leibovitz does photography. And whether you're just kind of a polymath, want to learn more about some of these subjects, watch the class, or really get in depth and get better at these things and do the exercises, Masterclass is awesome for either of those courses. You can watch it on your phone, your tablet, Apple TV, your computer. They also have downloadable lesson recaps, a bunch of supplemental materials. For example, some of these cooking classes come with awesome guides that are the level of a high-end cookbook, and users give Masterclass an average rating of 4.7 out of 5 stars. In case for some reason you're not satisfied, they offer a 30-day money-back guarantee on the annual all-access pass. Once again, the way to get started with them and get that buy one, get another one free to gift, all-access pass, go to masterclass.com/PER. Remember, John Hollinger invented PER. Easy to remember that one. Masterclass.com/PER. Let them know that you came from us. All right, what do you want to start with on the Nets? Put 4 minutes on the clock here.
Okay, so we have about 20 versions of the same question. I'll pull the one by doobie_y. Should the Nets sell high on Dinwiddie to help resolve crowded backcourt after Kyrie and LeVert return?
So, yeah, by the way, that's doobie_y.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes.
Just so people know.
There are other spellings of Doobie that imply different things. Yes.
Or at least did 30 years ago.
Hey, that was my prime, man. So the Dinwiddie question regarding Kyrie and LeVert is really interesting because when those guys were playing, the Nets looked kind of underachieving. And now that they're out of the lineup and Dinwiddie's running everything. He's playing like an all-star. And so what happens when these two guys return? Do the Nets have a couple options? I think, you know, do you sell high on Dinwiddie right now, given what his, hugely favorable contract if he's going to be a go-to guy for your team, right? Do you trade Kyrie? I mean, is that on the table? Or do you risk pissing off Durant and so you can't do that?
And don't forget, too, Dinwiddie was like the big reason that Kyrie wanted to come, who was then the reason that Durant wanted to come.
That's a good point. What a domino effect. Wow.
To me, LeVert is the guy to move.
To me, okay, so LeVert to me is a little bit tangential to the other. Like, I don't think LeVert is that great. He has great promise, but he's not – the current version of him is an overrated player, I think.
Yeah, but his value is only going to go down, especially now that Dinwiddie – I mean, you're basically like between Dinwiddie, Kyrie, and KD, there's really no purpose for LeVert anymore. And Dinwiddie is better than LeVert.
I agree he's better, but what is Dinwiddie doing when Kyrie and Durant come back?
Well, he'll play backup point guard. He can shoot well. I know he's not shooting amazingly well, but I think he's an acceptable spot-up shooter. He can defend the two. So I think your question is, like, can he be in the closing lineup with those guys?
Like, you're asking him to be almost a 3-and-D guy when those are the two least exceptional things about his game.
Yeah. No, I think that's a reasonable point. But again, I mean, I think you just – the in a perfect world, you probably would explore the market, but I just don't think – especially because – it seems like a little bit of a chemistry house of cards here anyway, to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
That throwing, and Dinwiddie, I think, is a really good chemistry guy. That seems pretty clear to me. So, I wouldn't necessarily be in favor of doing that, at least until you gotta, maybe next trade deadline, once you see KD and Kyrie and Dinwiddie all together. I mean, you don't really know what KD is gonna be, and what is the overwhelming package that you would get for Dinwiddie?
What if Orlando calls you and says, we'll give you, I don't know, Fultz and two firsts or something? Or we'll give
Fultz,
you.
Fultz is a terrible fit with their guys.
Okay. But, all right.
Yeah. No, but at that level of thing, I realize what you're saying.
Or Orlando calls and says, we'll give you Aaron Gordon or something. You know what I mean? I agree they should just deal for whatever, but there are potential situations, I think, where a team could make an offer that would be reasonable for that team and also really make Brooklyn think about it.
Yeah, it's so hard for me to do that without the information of what this team looks like with KD back. So I agree with you. I mean, LeVert, I got no problem moving. They effectively can't trade him now, though, until the offseason. So it does seem like there's not really a way for much to happen unless it is Dinwiddie. Maybe you could package him with DeAndre Jordan. It really, really mess up your chemistry and, use him as a way to get off of Jordan in addition to getting some assets. But, because they obviously the 3-and-D wing is what they really need. I think Jared Allen is actually, I know he had a rough game last night, but he's playing well enough.
Yeah, I agree. I don't think center is a worry. Jared Allen just had a couple of Shaqton plays last night, but he's been good.
Okay, let's move on here. Charlotte Hornets. Bunch of questions here about Devontae Graham. We'll take this one from Will Freeborn. Is Devontae a piece the Hornets should consider building around, or should they shop him in the near future while his value is sky high and begin their rebuild in earnest? I mean, I don't think he's good enough that he's going to like mess up your rebuild.
Yeah, he's a good player. He's one that they'll obviously need to talk about what his future should be contractually with them and how he fits into their cap environment. But Charlotte has so much clear cap going forward that paying him isn't going to be an issue. Even with Rozier on the books, paying him isn't going to be an issue. Even if they want to sign another max free agent, paying him isn't going to be an issue. You look like they're very clear after this year. But I do think there are more questions regarding like how good is he? How does he fit with Rozier? And they have enough time to find the answers to those questions, though, especially because he's on one of those 3-year second round contract deals. So you don't have that barrier to an extension that you have with a first round pick where it has to be done by the first day of the season. They could do it in the middle of next season or next June 2021. They could do it.
Yeah. And to be clear, he is a non-guaranteed next year at the minimum, and then becomes a restricted free agent in the summer of 2020.
I'm going to go out on a limb and say they pick up the guarantee. That's my hot take for today.
All right, what else you got here?
Well, I have to take a question as a Redskins fan from Spurrier FTW. Remind me of one of the many golden eras of post Joe Gibbs Washington Redskins football.
Right. Well, if they hire Urban Meyer, you'd be right back there. Another ex Florida coach. They've done so well.
Oh my goodness. All righty. Do you think he asked? Do you think Rozier and Devontae Graham can be a long-term backup pairing for the Hornets?
Or backcourt pairing? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. A backup pairing, you'd have a really good team.
You know, what is Charlotte trying to build? I mean, we've seen that they wanted to just, you know, be the fifth seed if they're lucky, in the eighth seed or the 12th seed if they weren't a lot of years. So you probably don't have enough size there ultimately to be a real high level second round of the playoffs kind of team. But you know, they're so far away from that, maybe you ultimately run into some questions about it, where you see when they land in the draft, right? I think that if they can get those two guys to actually be decent enough fits, and maybe one ends up coming off the bench.
That's what I think.
Yeah.
If one of them's your third guard and one of them's your starter, you're feeling pretty good about yourself.
Yeah. But, and they can both shoot. I mean, Rozier
can
defend and he can shoot. And so you get 48 good minutes of point guard play. They can play some time together. And then maybe you hope to, in the draft, get a ball dominant star who's more of a wing guy, who could play next to either of them at times. And we know how comfortable Rozier is coming off the bench as well. So that shouldn't be a
so it shouldn't be any problem at all, right?
Although, I mean, now that he's paid, perhaps it wouldn't be as much of an issue. But no, I mean, they're so far away from doing anything. It's like, these are decent players. Yeah. You know what? You're not going to win a championship with a Devontae Graham, Terry Rozier backcourt, but you know, 22 teams are never going to win a championship in a year. So
in the short term, you have time to ride this out and see what you have because of their contract situations. You don't have to make that decision today or tomorrow or even within the next year if you don't want to.
All right. Last question here. This is a good one. Miles Bridges or PJ Washington? Do the Hornets need to make a choice between them? Now I would say no, but just in general, who do you think is the better prospect among those two guys?
I like PJ a little better. I just think he has a little bit more skill to him that can develop in different directions.
His defense is sneakily pretty terrible, I've found.
Yeah, I think there's some validity to that. And that's part of the reason he's often not on the floor late in games and they turn to Marvin Williams. He has to get better there.
By the way, Marvin Williams, I think, could really help a playoff team. I don't know what the trade is that gets him there, but like, I think he could play 25 minutes a game in the playoffs.
Getting to his number is going to be hard. That's why he may end up being a buyout guy instead. I think he has enough equity there that if he came to them and said, look, I want to play in the playoffs, they'd be cool with it.
Yeah. I mean, 65% true shooting this year. He can switch. He protects the rim. Like, he's a good player.
Yeah. And he doesn't need the ball. Yeah. Yeah. For what contending type teams are usually looking for, he really fits the bill because he can even play five in a lot of situations, a lot of, you know, playoff type situations where everyone's trying to size down and junk up the game. He can play in those scenarios.
All right, let's get to the Bulls here. It's Evie. First asked if he's in the right conference this time. We hilariously had a number of submissions for the Eastern Conference when we were doing the Western Conference last year, or last week, but this time we are in the right conference, Evie. The Bulls use Wendell Carter Jr. as an old school rebounding and dunks big on offense. Do they need to utilize him differently to improve the offense and any other things that they could be doing to improve offensively right now?
He's really reluctant to shoot the ball.
Yeah.
And it's
taking a few more in like the last couple of games. But yeah, it's definitely been a storyline in Chicago this year.
And it's odd because he was never a great shooter at Duke, but he was at least something of a threat. And he's just, there's so many times where he just pulls the ball that the record scratches, as you call them.
Yeah.
And they hurt more on a team like Chicago. Like in Toronto, I'll use the example of Marc Gasol, right? Like when he pulls down the ball on an open shot, it doesn't shoot. They usually have somebody else who can still create a shot out of that possession. Because what does he do? He passes it to Lowry or Van Vliet or Siakam, and they dribble and create something. Maybe it's not quite as good a shot as the one Mark passed up, but it's at least in a somewhat similar neighborhood. Whereas when you turn down a shot and then you're like, hey, Ryan Arcidiakono, here, do something with this in the last 5 seconds of the shot clock. I mean, that's just that's just a killer. And so I think he has to be more of a threat, and that'll open up some other things. Cause like he could do some stuff like with passing, and like he has some craftiness to him, but if you don't have to guard him, it doesn't matter.
Yeah. He's taking only about 10% of his shots outside of 15 feet and shooting under 20% on such shots so far this year. Obviously, that's a very limited number overall for them to get better. And I do think Carter, I've been impressed with the strides he's taken as a finisher around the basket this year. I think that's something that he can point to be happy about. His overall efficiency is back where it needs to be if you're going to be a center. But yeah, you would like to see him roll to the basket a little bit more aggressively as well. I think their big problem though has just been, like, if you look at their shot mix, it's some of the best in the NBA. They're just not going in. And part of that is just, I think they don't have a ton of spacing. They miss a lot of shots at the basket. Zach LaVine also is starting to come around a little bit. Like, he had struggled throughout a lot of the year. Now he's starting to shoot it better. He's at 40% from three. Markkanen was really struggling. He's slight uptick.
Markkanen thing just baffles me. I still think every shot is going in when he shoots it. And they just don't. He's like the new Martell Webster. Like, wow, that looks beautiful, back rim.
Yeah, no, it's true. I mean, he's not been that 40% from three guy that you thought he would be. And that would change so much to me for this team. But they're also starting Chris Dunn at the three right now.
Yeah.
You know, you're only missing Otto Porter, really the one guy who is least replaceable on this whole team.
100%.
Him being out this whole year, and he was such a reliable spot-up shooter. To go from him to Dunn is such a massive downgrade. And Thaddeus Young is having his least efficient year in forever as well. I mean, Thaddeus Young shooting 45% on twos, I mean, that's not acceptable.
Yeah.
He shoots only around the rim on those twos.
Yeah, it's been a rough go for Thad this year. I've been really, really surprised. I thought he'd really help them. And
defensively, I think he has. Like, they've been good defensively. You know, despite maybe the unsustainability of some of that, but he's helped them a ton there, at least.
And that's where Dunn has helped. I mean, Dunn has a case to be on the all defense team. I think he's been fantastic at that end. Just offensively, he just takes so much off the table.
Bunch of questions about like potentially trading Zach LaVine. I think that's just one of these. Well, they're underperforming, so let's trade the best player. You know, it's a very kind of like 20 years ago sort of. Thought. I mean, I think he's starting to play better. I don't know that. I mean, defensively, I think he's a problem, but they've defended okay still with him out there. Maybe the thought is, hey, we got to get way out on the floor and pressure up and force a bunch of turnovers, because if we try to stay solid, Levine's going to screw up for us anyway. So we might as well like try to scramble around and force some turnovers, because we're going to give up open shots regardless, even if we stay solid, because LaVine will never do that.
Yeah, you see, I don't get why they're so. So pressure happy. I mean, it's working, but I just wonder if they could be even better, and if they might have more energy left for offense. If they're a big team, like they should, you look at them and you think they could just use their size and kind of play a pretty conservative scheme with these, you know, Markkanen, Carter, Satoransky's 6'7" playing the point, you know, LaVine is jumping bean 6'5". I mean, again, having Porter would help again. But like even their backups are pretty big.
So, I mean, the question of any contenders that could use LaVine, it just doesn't really seem to make sense to trade someone that age who's making, I consider him a decent value on that contract. His ideal role probably is like a sixth man on a really good team, you know, close some games if you're doing well, but you know, not every team is a really good team, and teams need scoring, and he's the only one really who can do it off the dribble for these guys.
Yeah. I mean, offensively, he's getting to the point where he's a good offensive player now. And
He's shooting 40% from three on really difficult attempts.
And he's figuring out how to draw fouls, which he never did before. And, you know, he still occasionally, his shot selection gets questionable, but that's really the only thing you can point at now. Yeah, he's become a really good offensive player, and it underscores how bad the rest of their offense is, that they're still a bad offensive team with him. What do you think Felicio's trade market is?
Oh, we saw him this week.
Yes.
He's playing for the Windy City Bulls.
He was, you know what? He was actually on my plane to the showcase, believe it or not.
Oh, man. So you fly first class all the time? That's awesome, dude.
I got upgraded at the buzzer, actually. It was a nice perk.
Oh, he actually, I guess you have like a shitload of points. You probably do fly first class.
So many Delta miles. Yes.
From Atlanta. All right, let's do a quick read here, and then we'll get into some of the rest of these. All right, Cleveland, Ryan Anderson, Ryan and 709, 38152. I'm reminded of there's an episode of Star Trek: The Next Generation where Data somehow gets reprogrammed to take control of the Enterprise, and he is able to mimic Picard's voice to like get voice command of the ship, and then he creates this password, this voice password that is like, you know, 100 numbers long, and he just says them all in Picard's voice, and like that's what that guy's Twitter handle reminds me of. This has been your weekly Star Trek: The Next Generation throwback.
Speaking just of in case this podcast ago. Wasn't getting geeky enough, we got some Star Trek for you.
Okay, so we say what Ryan's question actually is here.
Yeah, he says, "What's your assessment of Kevin Porter Jr. so far?" I think if you just pretend that Porter was the fifth pick and Garland was the 30th pick, you might feel a little better about the Cavs.
So you like him then?
I have very mixed feelings about him, but it hasn't been a great draft, and I think his minutes have been more promising than Garland's, because he has that first step, that kind of athletic juice that you're not going to be able to teach. He's actually an okay passer. I still question his shot. It's a weird push. The spin's all messed up. He was able to convert a decent percentage at USC on a small sample. But I still don't know if I really trust that shot of his, but he's an athletic wing who can do some stuff. Now, the tricky thing with Porter is that a lot of teams in the draft had a lot of questions about him off the court and what he was doing and what, you know, there was some stuff even at USC, and we just don't know how that's going to manifest itself. But in a team like Cleveland's situation where they're so devoid of talent, I think they at least have to be encouraged that late in a bad draft, they have somebody who you could imagine becoming a starting wing in a couple years.
The fact that he's shooting the ball better from the free throw line is good. He had this weird thing where he's shooting like 50% from the foul line in college. Again, he played half a year or two. He's finishing around the rim extremely well. And imagine how well he can do that once he discovers that appendage attached to the upper right side of his body.
Yes, very left-handed, definitely.
And he's playing out of position at the three, like asking him to defend threes. I mean, that's just unfair to what he is at this point in time, but they just have so many guards that's just where he's going to get playing time. So, yeah, I mean, I think he was talented, and to be able to at least show some flashes as the number 30th pick that they basically just bought has to make you feel pretty good. So speaking of Garland, what is wrong with Darius Garland? Is he done for as a star prospect? Asks Country Billy at Dan Soch.
I don't think you can say done for this early on almost any prospect. The odds aren't looking real great. So let me play excuse-orama. He missed last year with a knee injury, right? So he may still be in some ways physically working back from that, even though he's cleared to play and fine and not like overtly limping or anything. But there are some subtle things to coming back from that can take a little longer. He can shoot at least decently. I think one of the things that's hurt is he hasn't been like a crazy shooter. He's just been okay. And I think he needs to be a crazy good shooter to really make it as a starting guard. He also, in the Memphis game the other night, I will say they put him on Ja Morant and he did a pretty good job. That's probably the best I've seen him hold up defensively this season. And so that would provide some encouragement. Now
I do think he tries to do the right things defensively, even if he just lacks physicality and any kind of like scrum under the rim and they just have no size on that team.
Yeah.
But I think he does try to make the right rotations. He does try to give an effort.
Yeah. And the other thing that hurts him is he's just not a plus athlete to me. Like Sexton is athletic. Like he does stuff where you go, whoa. And that just never, there's never a whoa with Garland. It's just never happening. And so he has to get his skill level to the point where he's, you know, top 5% in the league to offset that to me. He's smallish. He's not a point guard really. Like what is his advantage has to be just crazy skill, and he's not there.
Yeah. I mean, I know this is like a bullshit analytics stat, but he has a 7.6 PER right now.
Who the hell came up with that crap?
But I mean, so never ever gets to the foul line. One of the things when I had Chris Fedor on their writer for Cleveland.com on my show before the season to do their preview, he said they're talking about, oh, he's a true point guard. He's going to be like diming guys up. You didn't really see that in college. You're not seeing that at all. You know, the passing between him and Sexton is poor, as Kevin Love could probably tell you. He never gets a rebound. I mean, he turns the ball over a lot. He can't finish at the rim when he gets in there. The floater game hasn't been like some massive thing. So the only flashes you'll see is every once in a while he'll cross a guy up and, you know, go for a super deep three-pointer that he'll make. But it just, even the guys who were terrible statistically, like that's not necessarily so much what's bothering me as just the total lack of flashes that you see from him of like, oh, this is what he could be. Yeah. And yeah, you know, maybe the hope is.
You compare it to Sexton last year, where Sexton was horrible at the beginning of last year, but there'd be, in the midst of like 20 horrible plays, there would be two or three where you went, oh, where you could see why, okay, that's why they picked him where they did.
Yeah. Man. Well, and Sexton hasn't really been any good either. So that's another problem. Well, if you're, okay. Detroit, Cactus, Carlo, what do you think the Pistons should look for in a potential trade for Drummond and or Blake? So A, should they be traded? I mean, those names didn't come up as much when we did that pod. And what should they look for them? I mean, I guess you're just looking for something at this point.
Anything, somebody, if you do. Somebody, please offer us something. I mean, Detroit is just so painted into a corner that it's going to be really hard to get themselves out of just long-term purgatory with this team where... Yeah.
I mean, you look at these guys. Who is the best player on their team right now that realistically is going to be there in 2 years?
Luke Kennard.
Yeah, that's it. That's the only... And Siku, if he, you know, if he develops. I mean, that's probably... Those are your two guys. Derek, like, to the extent they've been decent this year...
It's been Rose and Derek Drummond, Rose, right?
Yeah, and those guys, you know, not necessarily part of what they're doing. Now, you could see Drummond just being brought back just because it's like he doesn't have anywhere that really wants him and Detroit doesn't have any better options. So, hey, we'll just keep him around and try to be respectful again next year.
He could also opt in because if he opts out of 28.7, I don't see him getting that in this market.
Yeah, I was having a conversation with an executive, which, you know, that's one of the things that's so hilarious is like when you have these conversations and you can then report and say, oh, like a league executive like said this and it's like, oh, now I can put this in my column. And yet it's like, I mean, you being in this situation, you can correct me if I'm wrong here, but like, I mean, you didn't really know much more than you do now as you're sitting here talking to me, do you?
In many
like about like what's going to happen in the league, or like when you're making like predictions about like is Drummond going to opt out, or
are these guys going to make a trade or whatever. In a scenario like this, probably not. In a scenario like this, I probably would have been spitballing just as much as anyone else. Obviously, when you've will Team X trade player Y? That's where you tend to operate with a little more information because if you've done your homework, you kind of get an idea of whether of the extent to which that player is available.
Yeah.
But something like this, I think everyone's roughly equally in the dark.
Yeah. And even then, I think you're kind of just, it's interesting just that you can add, say, oh, well, a league executive said this, and now there's like this patina of expertise where it's like, well, I mean, some things they might know and some things they might just be sitting here and we're just having a conversation. But hey, you know, people eat that shit up. So, I'm going to keep doing it.
Hey, you know who else is a Piston 2 years from now?
Yeah.
Blake Griffin at the low, low price of $39 million.
Hey, he might opt in.
you think he'll opt in?
it really is a bummer, though, that he was so good last year, and then that injury has robbed him of whatever he had. That was one of those, oh, he can't make it worse, you know, type of thing, so come back and play. And every time I've heard that, I'm like, okay, it's one of two things. Either he can't make it worse because it's already so bad, there's no further damage to do, or they're wrong and he clearly does make it worse. I mean, every time you hear that, the guy playing on something, he can't make it worse.
Yeah,
he
comes Brandon back Roy, right? Hey, he can't make it worse.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's like the poster. Meta World Peace did that 1 year too with the Lakers. It's never, and it always is with one. It's hilarious to me because it's always one of these like meniscus, cartilage, debridement type of surgeries where it does seem like you can make it worse. I don't know. I don't understand why you'd be saying that you can't make that worse. Anyway. Oh, I'm not a doctor. all right. Let's move on to Indiana here.
Sure.
Mark Walsh, 72-72. If Oladipo returns to 89% of what he was by playoff time, how good are the Indiana Pacers?
Okay, so first things first, I think we need to rain on the parade a little bit with Indiana, that they've been very fortunate to amass the record they have in terms of just you're not going to play every game against Cleveland the whole year, and they probably with point differential are a little fortunate too. So I think even though Oladipo potentially coming back pushes them forward, I think other factors push against them.
Yeah, fair enough. But I guess really the question you're looking at is where do they fall into the Boston-Toronto hierarchy here, Miami hierarchy as that second tier in the East is kind of where we're looking at ultimately.
Yeah. I mean, can they play with any of those teams with Oladipo? Probably. I mean, you look even 2 years ago, they took LeBron to the seventh game and probably should have won that series with a lot of the same things that this team has. I mean, technically some of the players were different, but like, okay, you have, Brogdon instead of Collison, right? Like it's the same. Functionally, a lot of the things are the same about it. And like 1 through 9, this team's pretty good, like in a playoff series. Like I think they're strong. I just they don't really have a lot of superstar power to them, and I think even Oladipo coming back probably isn't going to give you that. They're just kind of top to bottom solid. The way it's kind of similar to how Toronto is, except I'm not sure they're quite as strong at each spot as Toronto is.
Yeah. So to quantify a little bit what you were just saying, cleaning the glass has Indiana right now, excluding garbage time, with a +5.5. net rating. Mm-hmm. And 538 projects the Pacers at the end of the season to be +1.8. So that will show you how much harder their schedule is going to get. Maybe there's some regression baked in there as well. I don't think they're particularly high on the Pacers at the start of the year. And I don't know what their projection is for Oladipo, but that does just show you a little bit that clearly their schedule early on has been pretty easy. Yeah, it's tough to say because they are going to be a different kind of team. If you see them, say, matching up against Boston and, Boston doesn't really have any kind of a way to deal with Sabonis, are they going to be able to just switch around enough behind the play and double team to deal with that? But I think, 80 to 90% of Oladipo, if that's the assumption, I don't think that gets it done to beating those other teams, especially because, as you mentioned, some of their appeal is their depth, and you can't bring that to bear as much in the playoffs.
Can I add a what if?
Yeah.
What if they trade Turner? What if they traded Turner and got somebody who meshes better with Sabonis?
As a four?
As a four, like a 3-4.
I mean, I hate to rain on your parade, but like what actual player is that?
I don't know. A player.
I know these pesky questions can get difficult, but it does have to be the 3-4. Combo four that created in a lab that we could trade Miles Turner for. Is that guy?
Yeah, I'm sure Toronto would like trade Siakam for him, right?
Yeah, yeah, it does get a little harder. A big concern about them is who is going to guard Siakam or some of these guys on Boston or Jimmy Butler. That I think it is a concern when you're looking at a potential 4-5 or 3-6 matchup in the first round. I think ultimately to me, they don't have enough scoring punch with Oladipo at 80 to 90% of what he was, especially because what made him so good was just that nuclear athleticism out of the pick and roll to just blow by guys and get to the rim, him getting older and coming off this injury, questionable whether that's going to still be there.
Yeah, I think there's still going to be, even when he comes back, I think there's still just going to be a lot of 2-point jump shots from this team.
Okay, I'm going to modify this question quickly. Steven Ragsdale, what is your evaluation of the Suburner?
Wow, you inadvertently created a great nickname.
It's a burner. So just give me like a 1 to 10 rating of how well that pairing has worked for you so far.
I don't know, 6.5. Like they're good, yep. Right? Like, yeah. You know, it's just.
It's been a lot better than I thought. Compared to expectations, I would say it's like, you know, an 8 to me.
Although, I mean, their best stretch of the year was when Turner was out, right? I'm not totally sure that was an accident.
Okay. The Miami Heat, 4 minutes on the clock for them. Luis Kazaku. Who would be the favorites in a possible 4-5 seed playoff battle between Toronto and Miami?
At full strength, I would go with Toronto on that one. Miami has one big thing in its favor is the Jimmy Butler factor, but I just think Toronto is just top to bottom a stronger team.
If you tell me that these guys, some of the guys who've been above expectations, continue to play at this level, I like Miami. I think the way they defend and just their overall athleticism, and I thought the end of that game that Miami won in Toronto was very telling to me, where Siakam, who's going to be their guy, could not get anything one-on-one. They really, I think they're really going to struggle to get shots against Miami. That would be an awesome coaching matchup too, between Spo and Nick Nurse. I think that would, it would be, and all those teams have so many pieces, so many interesting pieces like that. Yeah. And I mean, that we saw that game was like one of the best games of the year. And yes, if that's the 4-5, please sign me up for it.
I'm with you on that. Absolutely.
Yeah. And then you take in Miami's superior home court advantage to Toronto as well. Sorry.
home club advantage, maybe.
Okay. Who is the gettable player that can put Miami over the top? Certainly. One more real elite pick and roll guy to me is what they need, is just a general player archetype.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Drew Holiday.
That was the first name I was going to come up with, who's not perfect offensively, maybe. Like, he is, I guess, a pick and roll guy, but he's, I don't know if he's like the main guy on a high level playoff team with that, but you put in his defense with Butler and Bam. Like, oh my goodness. Good luck scoring on this team, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, I think that's, I'd be very interested to know what the value of their young guys who emerge. Hero, supposedly, from the discussions I had, they're like viewing him as untouchable right now. I mean, you know,
well,
untouchable
guys have a way of becoming touchable when all stars become available. So
yeah,
I could see to me, if you don't have future firsts, which the Heat basically don't, then you got to put Hero on the table if you want to get anybody good. You got to say, okay, it's going to be Hero and Winslow, and then take all these guys.
So none, and Duncan Robinson on minimum contracts for another 2 years. That doesn't do it for you.
I just don't think a rebuilding ish team is going to care. I mean, you still have to pay them something at the end of the day. Your big advantage is next year when you have them for 1.6. But
yeah. Yeah, I think you can make the argument they're worth more to Miami now than they are to anyone else.
I would agree with that, especially in the Heat's salary situation. So, I mean, to me, the guys you're trying to trade are like, you know, the same four or five guys they've been trying to trade for like the last 4 years, right? But like,
yeah, I mean, Winslow clearly is in that deal.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, you know, maybe there's a, it depends. No one really seemed to have an idea at the showcase of, clearly this is out there for a reason, that they at least are listening on Holiday, but no one has seemed to have any kind of an idea of like, A, what Griff would want in terms of like assets. I mean, the one thing that was thought is like, hey, they got to at least get a player who's going to contribute on the floor right now. It can't just be draft picks. That was one thought. But then also, what does he think the value of Drew really is? You know, Mike Conley, it's going to be above that. In theory, well above that is what he's going to be wanting. But do other teams see it that way? Do other teams who might be going after him have assets to even pay more than that?
Yeah. And the other thing is that because Holiday still has the years left on his deal, I mean, he has one and then the opt-out, I guess. So it's 1.5 and then his opt-out, which is exactly where we were with Mike Conley last February, where the ball is still in your court to say, if we don't like what's out there at the trade deadline, we can wait. You know, fine, we'll go to the draft. So because of that, I do think you're going to have to meet their price a little bit. And if something falls short of whatever they've internally decided his value is, they'll just wait. They don't have to deal him right now.
No, it seems more likely that that's something that could happen in the summer and that they still want to see what he looks like with signed. Okay, Milwaukee, I think this is an interesting one. Bojack Sigma at People's Reporter. Man, a lot going on there.
Yeah.
Forget whether the Bucks should have traded Brogdon and not re-signed him. Did they fail to use him properly as a playmaker when they had him last year? And did that lower their ceiling last year?
You could argue that Bledsoe got in his way. I mean, based on seeing him in Indiana now, that they could have had him on the ball more, especially when Giannis was out of the game. And they didn't because they had Bledsoe. And basically, honestly, they decided to pay Bledsoe instead of Brogdon, right? They just did it ahead of time by doing the extension. So that's a really interesting basketball what if, is what if they had decided that Brogdon would be that guy and not Bledsoe? Or what if they hadn't done the Bledsoe trade at all? They'd still be sitting on another first too.
Well, yeah. And they really, I mean, the idea to me, that Brogdon would be way better than Bledsoe as soon as this year, last year, would have been a surprise to me. Now, also
that,
remember
that's a fair point. I mean, Brogdon, especially his second year, he struggled after winning that Rookie of the Year. So we're saying all this with 2010 hindsight, right? So
no, actually, I think in 2010, no one had even ever heard of Malcolm Brogdon.
Oh no, I'm turning in terms of vision charts.
I'm okay. Sorry. I won't do that again. Yeah. What use is it talking about the decade before 20? All right. Going back to that though, the Bucks ran some of the fewest pick and rolls in the league. The way Brogdon has thrived has been they've been running a lot of pick and roll, and they've got some really good roll men on that team. Now you would think, hey, a Brogdon Giannis pick and roll, maybe they should have done more of that. But you mentioned that he was the two. You mentioned that Bledsoe wasn't necessarily providing as much spacing. He also was injured and came back in the Boston series too. So it's hard to say, you know, maybe they could have evolved more into that over the course of an entire playoffs with two more months. But I think they weren't trying to feature Brogdon as much when he'd just come back from injury.
And Bledsoe was actually good in that Boston series too.
Yeah. Yeah. He had some ugly shooting games, but he also had the, oh, redemption against him for.
Yeah. Scary Terry. Yeah. Exactly.
All right, here's one. Common Pa. Mm-hmm. Which Bucks player other than Giannis will have the greatest impact on their success in the postseason? I believe it will be Brook Lopez. Our buddy Seth Partno has been talking about him in the Defensive Player of the Year conversation. And you remember, especially in that Toronto series, they sucked whenever Lopez was off the floor. So he would be the guy, especially because he's going to need to not only space the floor, but he's going to need to make those really deep three-pointers as well, which, you know,
he's kinda been struggling with that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Really,
yeah.
Since the summer with USA.
Yeah. So, I mean, he takes those. It looks awesome. I mean, he definitely has the reputation. But, you know, maybe teams like, hey, he's not hitting it. We're not going to guard him over the course of a playoff series. Like, that can evolve even if a guy has a decent history in the regular season.
Yeah. It's interesting because you're tempted to think that he can be schemed off the floor by a smaller, faster team, but nobody's really been able to do it.
Nobody in the East is doing that.
Yeah, yeah.
And the Lakers aren't going to.
Clearly, yeah.
Yeah. So, no, I mean, this isn't – and he's been one of their best players against Houston over the years. So, I mean, there isn't a golden – this whole, like, we're going to get guys off the floor thing.
The team that could scheme him off the floor is Milwaukee. Right, because they could put Giannis at five and Middleton at the four, and then Lopez has nobody to guard. But
yeah,
he never has Clippers, to play them.
Maybe the Clippers.
Oh, I could see. It. Yeah, you're right. You could see the Clippers getting funky.
Yeah, because really, the way you scheme him off the floor is you got good ISO guys, and then you're also, you know, and like mid post ISO guys, not just James Harden either. Mm-hmm. You force him to drive at the three, then you go into the help, and you get spacing around him. Okay, let's do the New York Knicks. Wow, there's a lot of Bucks questions. Sorry we didn't get to all those. Let's make this one a lightning round here for the Knicks.
Please.
Any changes that you've seen under Mike Miller at all? Basically, is where Chris Perselli is going. Let's do 30 seconds on that one.
You know what? I haven't watched a lot of Mike Miller era Knicks. I'm not sure I have a good answer on that one.
Yeah, I think they are playing harder to me. I saw them in person in the game where they almost blew a couple of 10-point leads and then killed the Warriors in overtime. This was against the Warriors too. I mean, the Warriors just have this inexplicably terrible offense, even with Russell back. So I think one thing that they've done is just they've defended a little bit better. They've played a little bit harder. I think once they were 2-8 in that presser for David Fizdale, it was clear to everyone that he was going to be gone. And so it was really hard for him to get some effort. I mean, a big other thing is that they've had Elfrid Payton back.
Yeah,
and while Payton. Yeah.
Yeah. The one time I watched them, Payton played well. They won the game in Sacramento, and it did seem that that made a pretty big difference. I mean, Ntilikina, as much as a fan favorite he's become for some weird reason, is just so limited offensively that he really handcuffs them.
Yeah. And he was removed from the starting lineup in their last game against the Bucks, which did not help. The Bucks, they don't match up too well with the Bucks, as it turns out.
Few people do.
Okay. Tim Boeheim, you run another average NBA team. Steve Mills kidnaps your family and for ransom insists that you take one of Frank Ntilikina, RJ Barrett, or Kevin Knox off of his hands. Who do you pick? I mean, it's got
to
be RJ.
Oh, right? I mean, not even a debate. I mean, yeah. Barrett still has a chance to get some, to hit some really high level outcomes. I mean, just because he hasn't been awesome right out of the gate. I mean, at his age and with his, you know, size and profile, I mean, there's still a lot of upside here. I wouldn't be dismissing that yet. Knox, I think that pick is, heading toward the B word.
I mean, I am lower than you on you than RJ. I think I don't necessarily see those outcomes because I just don't believe in his quickness or his shooting. You know, if he were 6'8 instead of 6'6, I might be a little bit more of a believer there, but
clarify, I'm not saying those outcomes are probable.
Right.
But there's at least like these, you know, these windows of probability that can get there where, not so much for Knox or Ntilikina, right?
Okay. Let's see. I always wonder, are the Knicks youngsters really that mediocre? Is it all about the wrong fit and game plan, et cetera, that makes them look so bad?
Yeah. And that's from, Oren Brooklyn.
Oh, thank you. Yes.
So I think it's a mix of both. I think they're not in a great structure, especially on the offensive end. I mean, most of the Knicks' problems have been on offense. I mean, they're just bad. The pieces don't fit at all. And so it's hard for a younger player to come into that, unless they're a lights out shooter, because that's the one thing they could probably use and really find their way. We talked about Elfrid Payton coming back, but even for him, I think it's hard to come back and be part of this offense where it's, where there's just not a lot of windows for somebody who's not a great shooter to make plays and have avenues to the basket. So, I think that's probably the biggest thing. I mean, I think we've all heard stories about the different dysfunction there at different times. I'm sure that's suboptimal as well, but on the court, I think it's just a hard place for a lot of these guys to play right now. The one guy who probably is okay out there is Dotson because he's a 3-and-D guy anyway.
Yeah, and it's like, not that the Knicks had a ton of draft picks over the years before the Porzingis era, and then they missed out in 2016, but it's not like these guys have gone elsewhere and been just like so much better than they were with the Knicks either. I mean, we'll see if Smith and Knox and Ntilikina, it seems like those guys are all destined to end up somewhere else potentially at some point. All right, we got four teams left here.
Okay.
Do one more quick ad, and then we will move on. Orlando Magic. Congratulations, Orlando. You had the fewest questions submitted about you, but we still got three. Let's see if we can get to all three of them here. At Pace and Space 1, could the Orlando Magic be in the running for Kevin Love? Could he play alongside Isaac if Isaac played a little bit more center?
Boy, I don't think Kevin Love is the guy for them. It would have to be Aaron Gordon, right? It would have to be. And I mean, I guess he had shooting and
could
stuff.
Be, like, could just be the straight expiring contract and like heavily protected first, you know, like, I guess they don't have any, you know, Terrence Ross maybe or something like that. Cause Cleveland needs another guy who shoots, from the two and doesn't play defense, but you know, maybe that's what it is. He could be the foundation and they get one other piece in there.
You're loading yourself up with so many 3.5s and 4.5s, which is basically what this team has already, that And even if you did say, I don't know, Gordon and Aminu or something, now you have a Love Vucevic 4-5 combo. I mean, good night defense.
And Isaac is already a 4-2. I mean, I guess, yeah, that's the, just, and then to say, oh, well, Isaac will just play center. Well, no, Kevin Love has to be your center defensively. Like, he can't move enough to play anything other than center, but he also doesn't protect the rim. That's the struggle with him.
Yes. So I don't like the fit there. I think Orlando's move is to get perimeter help. Whether it's a three who can push Isaac to the four, or it's another high level guard who can push Fultz to a bench role, or can push, one of Isaac or Gordon to a bench role and play with Fournier in the wing. They need more help on the perimeter and more just offensive playmaking juice on that team. And I just don't see another front court guy being the solution. I think if anything, it's subtraction in the front court where they're trading probably Gordon and trying to get a high level perimeter player instead.
The Cav who I think actually would help them the most is Jordan Clarkson, who's quietly having an underrated season and could give him a little more ball handling and punch off the bench. And he's shooting it well from three. I don't know what's going back there, with him being an expiring contract, but that's one that really probably hasn't been discussed enough on the trade market, that he's someone who could help one of these lower end playoff teams. You know, that's probably, he's more of a second round pick than a first round pick guy.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. But you know, I think that's where the trade market's going to be headed, is more towards the secondary guy. You know, they're not as sexy names, so people aren't really talking about them, but those are the guys who are much more likely to move.
Yeah. Yeah. When you can say, hey, you know what? We agree. You know, Gallinari, it's like, oh, second round pick. Why don't we just hold on to his bird rights? When it's a guy who's not that good, then it's like, oh yeah, whatever we can get for him, fine. That becomes a lot more, movable to me.
Yeah. And you usually see that with guys who are like between 6 and 9 in the rotation. The year we were truly awful, we finished 22-60, but we did that exact trade with Detroit. We traded James Ennis for a second round pick because they wanted another, quality rotation guy, and he was on an expiring. Like, it was the same situation basically. And that's how a lot of those deals end up happening.
Yeah, you did have it easier there because he was on the room exception, right? It was like $3 million. So
there was a lower number to get to. Yeah, they send us Bryce Johnson in a minimum contract, if I remember correctly.
God, you know, it's amazing that the Magic, I've like mentally written them into the playoffs and they're 12.
All the projections and stuff have them like clearing it by like 7-8 games, but they're barely hanging on here right now. If you just look at the standings.
So here's another one. Are you buying into the Mo Bamba reclamation project?
Wow. Is it that sad that he's already a reclamation project?
Doesn't he have to go to another team first?
Yeah, or like, I don't know, turn 25 or something. I don't know. He's made some progress. He's had moments.
Well, he's not the worst center in the NBA who actually gets rotation minutes anymore. I think that's he's not on the Atlanta Hawks. But he's shooting it okay. Like, that was a question I had. Is he going to shoot it? But I think to me, you know, I think his usage is actually too high right now. 19% usage, and he only takes 37% of his shots from three. Like, I think he needs to just become a pure 3-point Brook Lopez style specialist and just bomb it from out there. Because he just has so little feel and strength and hands inside the arc. It's like, just go stand out there and shoot it. Like that I think is really. There's this thought of like he should be trying to develop more in some ways. And maybe that's how he gets to be efficient enough. He does block a lot of shots. He doesn't do anything else defensively.
Yeah. But the other.
He's not great on the verticality.
The other thing that you get if you have him above the break shooting threes is that you always have him back.
I've always thought that something that's really underrated in transition defense is you have to get your bigs back. Because when you get your bigs back, then you're not. Your smalls don't get sucked in, and then you're not going to give up threes. You're not worried about giving up a layup at the rim. So, yeah, I think that's a pretty good point there.
And, you know, I don't think Orlando in general, I think that generally plays into how Clifford wants to play too. Not the 3-point bombing so much, but the like taking away transition and just kind of being solid at that end.
Yeah. And he's not like some amazing force on the offensive glass that like you want him going in there either. I mean, but I think him being a game-changing defensive player, you know, I think he's more like Bismack Biyombo than he is Miles Turner, if you want to make a comparison of what he's ultimately going to be, where, you know, he might do some things, but you're not going to look at him like, oh, this guy's going to make a great defense by himself, which is what you're hoping for when you drafted him.
Yeah. I mean, there's still time and everything, but yeah, I think that's the probable outcome.
I mean, if he turns into a lower end starting center, that wouldn't shock me, but is he a guy I think is going to be worth really paying for at the center position? I don't necessarily see that. Now, you know, maybe if he really becomes this awesome bomber from three, maybe that's what it is. We've seen guys develop that. He's pretty far along as a 20-year-old or 21-year-old in that level. Okay. One more here. We'll do this one quickly. JDM at option zero. Has Aaron Gordon plateaued due to talent or fit?
I would say it's more talent. I do think on another team, he might have a little more room to expand his game maybe, but he's a little bit jack of all trades, master of none offensively, right? So it's hard to see how that changes too much in a different environment. Will he become a great shooter all of a sudden? Will he become a great passer all of a sudden? Will, you know, maybe he'll have a little more space to do a few more things off the dribble or run a little more or get a few more alley-oops, but it seems more at the margins to me. What do you think?
Well, I thought that it looked like when he first came in that he was going to be this game-changing athletic force. And I think he really, whether due to some of these lower body injuries, I don't know what it is, but he's not that anymore. I mean, when's the last time you've seen these just like massive highlight dunks from him that you saw his first couple of years? And, you know, as a help defender, I don't think he's particularly impactful. He's really more useful as a on-ball guy who's not going to get overwhelmed physically. And then the shooting hasn't come around either. You know, Zach Lowe talks about, well, he's trying to do too much. He likes to do stuff with the ball. So maybe that part of it helps him be more efficient if he cuts that out. But no, I think he's just like, you know, could you see him going to, say, Houston and becoming more of a switch guy, someone who can just shoot the three only when he's wide open. He's got the green light. He shoots 35% from three. I mean, I think if you really put him in like that kind of a system, that might maximize him. You also have enough spacing to where he might be used as a role man sometimes. There's just more overall versatility. So I think there could be a better fit, but I don't think it's like, oh, you're going to be wowed by him and he becomes an all-star somewhere else. Like, he's not going to be Sean Marion the way I think everyone hoped that he would.
Yeah, that's a great comparison to what he – because that, I think that was when he came out in the draft, people did use that comp quite a bit. And I think that train has probably left the station.
Yeah. Also, I guess the other thing I would say too is like Steve Clifford teams not known for their transition prowess, like a team that ran more could get more out of him maybe.
Which, I mean, that, with Fultz playing on the, I mean, they actually probably should run more than they do.
Yeah. Yeah. Fultz does really boost that for him. Okay. Sixers here. Any of these, speaking to you?
Yeah, I mean, you could sort of feel the angst in the Sixers environment with questions like this one from Northern Hoops One. Should the Sixers look to restructure by moving Ben Simmons? If so, who would they chase? Is D'Lo a candidate? The struggles they've had offensively, I think, have people genuinely worried, and I think there's some good reason for that. I think not having Jimmy Butler now and losing some shooting in those moves they made as well to get Butler and Harris. When you think like, wow, they could have Landry Shamet and like things might be a lot more open. I think there's a general consensus they need to do something. Boy, I don't.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Zach Lowe was saying the other day he thinks they're gonna kind of keep it together at least for one full year and see what they have with this group.
I think that's probably the right move with their four or five core guys, just because when you're four bounces away from winning the championship, basically, which you can argue they were. I know they still would have had to get through Milwaukee and whatnot.
I think Milwaukee would have matched up better against them than they did against Toronto, personally.
That I think there's a fair point to be made there, but I also, I mean, the way their size on defense just swallowed up even good players on Toronto was impressive in that playoff series, and nobody else could do that.
They're always going to have a chance in a series for that reason, I think.
But conversely, they got to find a way to make life easier on offense and not just win a rock fight every day. And, you know, can they piece together some of these contracts when you look at Mike Scott at 4.7 or, you know, some of these other secondary players they have, to Ennis, who we talked about, although he's his minimum is 1.8. So that's a low number. You know, some of these guys like Korkmaz, Zaire Smith is at 3, is kind of a blah G League player right now. Like is it time for them to cut bait on that one and put him in a deal? I think that is probably the direction they need to look, where it's not so much you're going to subtract from that Simmons, Richardson, Horford, Embiid, Harris core, but can you get a sixth player who's like a $10 to $15 million player who helps you win and has more offensive juju to him?
Well, here's the other reason I don't think they're going to make any moves. Ben Simmons essentially can't be traded until the offseason because of the raise that he's getting. It's just the outgoing incoming salary is just, it's too difficult with that max extension that he got. Let's see here. What else do we have? Tobias Harris's defense. How legit is it? I think in this system, it looks good. He's at least big enough to not get overwhelmed physically in most matchups. His weakness is his foot speed, but you've basically got more help behind you than you're going to have in any other system. So I think he's made some strides to be good enough to where he's not going to be a liability, and I think that's important.
Yeah, I still worry about him as a three a little bit, but
yeah,
you have Embiid behind you, obviously, which helps, and you have Ben Simmons just generally terrorizing people. And Richardson, I mean, Josh Richardson's your third best defender, right? Like, that's a hell of a defense.
Is Thibault's defensive ceiling Draymond S? Asks Mr. Marshall 254.
Boy. Thibault's funny because he's not one of these guys who's like overtly out there pressuring the ball and stuff. Like, you don't really feel him. He's like a silent assassin almost. Like, you don't notice him until he's running the other way with the ball. And it was kind of the same way at Washington. Draymond was doing it where he could guard everyone 1 through 5. I don't think Thibault's quite that guy. He's like a really, I'd almost compare him to how Ricky Rubio is, where he's just so stealthy, except Thibault is bigger and better at it. And it's more on that level, though, than it did, like, Draymond gave you, like, this physicality where you guard the other team's 5, but still switch on the point guard and completely lock him up. Like Thibault isn't quite that. He's a different kind of defensive ace.
Yeah, I mean, he's an amazing playmaker, but the nuts and bolts he's not as good at. He's never going to be. He's just not strong enough to me, you know, where Draymond could lock up like a Blake Griffin in his prime. Thibault would get overwhelmed by someone like that. And also Draymond, just as his help instincts, verticality plays at the rim in addition to shot blocks, then the ability to switch out as well. No. So I mean, people love to compare somebody to Draymond Green. There may never be another Draymond Green, especially when you consider the talent around him that enabled him to be the all over the court.
I had this exact discussion a few years ago where somebody said somebody could be like the next Draymond, and I just shut it down and said, there is no next Draymond. there is one Draymond, and he's playing right now for Golden State, and that's the only one we're ever getting.
Yeah. And PJ Tucker is a little more realistic. I do think that there's something to be said for, if you've got quick feet and long arms and strength, that can be a very powerful combination
and nastiness
in the right system. Yeah. But you also have to have a system built around you, right? Like, if you're not switching, we've seen that this year with Draymond. In fact, if you're not switching, maybe it's not as bad. Now, not that Draymond's exactly trying this year. Okay. Toronto. Any of these, calling your name?
Toronto Raptors. Is Norman Powell for real? Which I think is a great question. This is from Aug24255. I think it's a great question because it's a question the Raptors should be asking themselves in order to assess what his trade value is for them and whether he is a piece that they would want to put in a deal to get a more significant piece if they want to really try to compete to defend their title this year or next year. Because there are advantages to putting Powell in a trade, because when you eliminate that 11.6 in 21-22, which, who knows, he may opt out of it anyway. But it does open the door to other things that I think are franchise goals. When you look at chasing after Giannis or chasing after some of the other high level free agents in 21, while still keeping Van Vliet and, you know, maybe having, you know, one or two pieces on top of that. So that's where it gets really interesting for the Raptors. I do tend to think that he's pretty legit. Is like, he's a very good third wing on your team, right? He's probably passable as a starter, but you're probably not over the moon about it either. Like you're still kind of looking around and trying to see if you can do better.
Yeah. So whenever someone says it's someone for real, you look at the 3-point shooting first. Per 36 minutes, it's really not much different than it was last year. 39% this year, but about the same number of attempts per 36 minutes. And last year he shot 40%.
He does not look like a 39% shooter. Like when you just watch him shoot.
No.
But God bless him. He go in.
Yeah. I mean, he is shooting a career high from two this year. I think he's like about right for his salary at this point, but has anyone fluctuated from good to bad contract more often and more rapidly than Norman Howell has over like what's now this fifth year of his career?
It's kind of
like
amazing.
He's gone back and forth like five times.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause he had a stretch right after he signed the extension where he was completely unplayable and he kind of worked himself out of that. So, and obviously at the beginning of his career as a second round pick, he was a minimum. So he was one of the best contracts in the league. And it's been a yo-yo for him. Now, he's probably trying to finally get into the back where he's like, he's probably kind of fairly valued right now.
Yeah. And he does have a little bit of on-ball juice attacking closeouts. His passing is subpar, not a big part of his game, I would say, but he could run a little bit of a pick and roll. He can get a little bit of an ISO shot. He's good in transition. He's not going to kill you defensively. So yeah, I mean, I think that's a valuable player. Yeah. I don't mind him as like a lower end starting two, and that's what he's paid like.
Yeah. Where he does help, Toronto is that he is good in transition and he's fast, and just the overall team speed of Toronto, when they have, you know, some of those lines, when they have Powell, Anunoby, Siakam out there, I mean, they just are a track meet. It is just so fast. And even having Mark out there doesn't really hurt him because Mark's going to zip an outlet pass up the court and hit one of those guys and they're just flying. And
yeah. And then he can always step into a trail three if it doesn't occur.
Or turn it down.
or at least make the right decision to move the ball.
Yeah, around. Exactly. That's what he's going to do. Yeah.
Sports guy dude one. How should the Raptors handle the overlap between Lowry and VanVleet? I can handle this one quickly. Well, they were playing them both like 37 minutes a game when they were both healthy. So, there isn't that much overlap. They can both shoot offensively. They can both handle the ball. They're both good off ball guys. And then defensively, they're both so strong and stout and intense that they're fine. I don't think that they take nothing away from each other. They're both starting and they both should be starting. So it doesn't bother me in the slightest.
Yeah. You hit on it with the strength. They don't play as short guards, even though they're both really short, because they're so strong and so tough that they can still handle guarding basically any two in the league.
Stephen Gillespie, with the East looking more wide open, how do you feel about the Raptors making another run to the finals?
The East, I'm not sure it looks more wide open. There's a team in Milwaukee.
The team that's playing like one of the greatest teams of all time in the conference. Like people just like forget about that. They have a 12.5 net rating right now.
Yeah.
Like they're pretty fucking good.
Wow. Is that our first F-bomb?
No. I am averaging like 0.6 per episode.
Wow. Okay. I've been tracking them. Huh.
Yeah. No, I mean, I want to see what's going to cause your first.
I got to step up my game on that front. I've not taken full advantage of the freedom that podcasting offers me to just swear like a motherfucker. And that's been a shortcoming of mine in this that I need to address.
No, that's true. I think like most people wouldn't know that you actually have like a little bit of a sailor's mouth. I think we really need to let that.
That's what's so weird, right? Like in real life, I swear all the time. And then I come on this and I just automatically clean everything up. Like I'm still, you know, working for a team and have to give nice, innocuous quotes. So anyway.
Okay. Last time here, Washington.
All right. I'm laughing at these questions. Do,
right?
Because it's all like, they're all about one player, right? So the real Ian McCoy asks, is Davis Bertans the greatest shooter in the league or the greatest shooter of all time?
He might be like the fourth best shooter in the league.
Legitimately. I mean, it's funny because when I was writing my all surprise team for The Athletic, what I realized was that the three players that I had at the top of my list were three guys who all basically were good shooters that realized that they could massively ramp up their volume and be more effective players. When you look at Bertans, Devontae Graham, and Duncan Robinson. Now, there were other things going on too, but one of the biggest things statistically is that they just started jacking, and they're such good shooters that it's a value proposition for them to do that.
Yeah, I agree with you. We always say that it's good for these guys to bomb, and especially if you know, some of these guys, for example, Brogdon is a perfect example, right? He was shooting 40% from three in Milwaukee, and you're like, hey, you know what? Like, it'd really be great if he took more attempts. Well, now he's on ball more. That's the one thing that's really declined. He's shooting in the mid-30s yeah. now instead of 40% because his attempts are harder. They're more on ball, off the dribble. He doesn't have the quickest release. You know, you're not running him off of screens or anything. But, yeah, I think anybody who can shoot like that, if you're shooting 40% for three, you should at least, like, explore, like, all right, can I shoot these on the move? I always call it the versatility of your jump shot. Can you expand the versatility of your jump shot? Hey, maybe your feet aren't totally set. Maybe you're kind of drifting away and you're still able to jack this up and, you know, shoot 35% on that instead of 40%. And then you get your wide open ones and you shoot at an amazing rate and you get to your 40% that way. But no, he's able to do that. And you know, I was asking someone in their organization, you know, what they thought of his defense. And, you know, of course, they were high on it because that's usually what they say. But they said, you know, he competes. We think, you know, if we had a little bit more personnel around him, that he could be adequate. So do you agree with that assessment of it?
I think he can, you know, he's good enough. Like, he definitely tries at a really high level, rebounds a little bit. You know, he's tall, which helps. There are definitely situations where he got taken advantage of, you know, when he was in San Antonio. But at the same time, offensively, he's so valuable that you're going to live with that at the end of the day. This sort of segues into another question here on Washington. C. Calderon 911217 asks, what are the Wizards doing wrong on defense? I mean, what they're doing wrong is not having any good defensive players on their team, right? Like, you know, you have Isaiah Thomas and Thomas Bryant and Bertans. Like, yeah, you're going to get lit. Like, that's your team. So you know, we could maybe quibble with a couple things scheme-wise or whatever, but at the end of the day, they just have a bunch of really crappy defensive players.
I can't remember the last – like, there's always injuries and there's always teams that just, like, end up being horrendous defensively or they have bad communication or whatever. But at the start of the year between Atlanta, Cleveland, and Washington, teams where you just look at their personnel, you're like, they have no chance.
Yeah,
they have absolutely no chance to stop anybody.
Yeah. And exactly. Just coming into the season, it was just like, your defensive stopper is Troy Brown, maybe? Like, and you looked at the bigs, obviously, Bryant and Wagner. Like, come on. Like, you're not stopping anyone with that.
So, and this is, I had this conversation with Fred Katz before the season of who is the best defensive player in the Wizards.
Oh, I had this conversation with him too. And it wandered into a lot of dead ends.
So, and I came up with Jan Mahimi, who I basically forgot had gotten healthy. I thought he was just going to be like, all right, he's going to get the Mozgov and he's just not going to play at all this year. He's not in our plans. Well, they've had to play him 152 minutes. They are 14.3 points per 100 better just on defense.
Wow.
With him on the floor.
Wow.
And yeah, I mean, I haven't looked at, like, you know, the 3-point shooting.
I got to be honest, Nate. I had forgotten Mahimi was on their team until I pulled up their salary sheet for this discussion. I just completely eviscerated him from my mind.
Yeah. No. And so they're like, but just to have one adult defensive player in the room, like a real NBA big man who just doesn't suck defensively, just makes such a difference for them, I think. And you know, that number is not going to maintain throughout the season. But over what was there, even Jan Mahimi, after 4 years of knee injuries and Achilles injuries and all this, is still just, like, so much better than what they had. I mean, that to me speaks volumes there. All right, you want to do one more and we'll pack it in here?
Yeah, sure.
Would you try to trade Bertans, asks Eric Shapiro, or try to re-sign him this summer?
I would probably try to re-sign him. I think you're not going to get killed on his number because there's not that many teams that are going to be your competition that can plausibly pay him. We talk about the forlorn five a lot on this podcast. I think a lot of those teams are pretty set at the four. You look at, like, is Atlanta going to pay another four? Is Memphis going to pay another four? I could maybe see Charlotte doing it. Cleveland, you know, right now their whole team is bigs. And then the Knicks, we'll see what direction they go. Maybe they could.
The Knicks actually, I would think very seriously about him if I were the Knicks. Now, they want to – can't mess up the 2021 plan, obviously, but I mean, just to get some kind of spacing around their young players. I think he's like an okay fit with Randall, who's going to be there next year as well. Okay, let Barrett run some pick and roll with Randall with Bertans spacing out. Man, now maybe you actually have something offensively.
Yeah, let me say this about the Wizards' intentions too with Bertans. I don't think this Anzis Pasechnich thing is an accident, okay? And I don't think he was signed because he's like an awesome basketball player who was killing the G League, let's say.
Because he's another Latvian guy.
There's like a Latvian connection here, and not just the fact that he's from Latvia. There's other stuff. So I think there's some of that going on where their intention is definitely to re-sign him.
Yeah, I can confirm he's not an awesome basketball player. All right, this is awesome. You want to get us out of here, John?
Yeah. First of all, I want to wish everyone a happy holiday season, whatever you celebrate, and wish everyone a happy new year. We'll be ringing it in with another pod next week. So be sure to subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Spotify or wherever you get them.